This is a podcast from Minute Media.
1-2 to Gleyber Torres. He struck him out, and the ball game is over. Edwin Diaz for the four-out save, four strikeouts. The Mets with a four-run first inning. Home runs from Marte and Escobar. Terrific defense all night long. And the Mets take the opener from the Yankees 6-3.
Game on the line. 1-0 to Marte. Peralta deals. Swinging a liner to left. Base hit. Put it in the books. Here comes Escobar. He scores the winning run. Marte slams his helmet down at first. The Mets have swept the Yankees. They have defeated them 3-2. The Mets pour out of the dugout. They are mobbing Starling Marte to the right of second base. The Mets have gained a game on the Atlanta Braves. They're now three up in the National League East as they have swept a two-game series from the Yankees, winning it 3-2 tonight in the bottom of the ninth inning on a game-winning single.
Does winning these games just kind of add to that ability for a team to do that?
Well, we'll see. You know, the proof is in the end game. But, you know, we've played a lot of emotional games here already. And anytime you play in New York and you play in front of our fans, there's a real engagement of it. Obviously, you know, I understand why it might be at a little different level tonight, and rightfully so. But, you know, pressure's, you know, it's kind of what you make of it. It's a privilege. And, you know, to be able to play in this, like I told the players in advance of me, it's a privilege to play in this environment and, you know, have fun, draw something from it, and, you know, you'll be able to reach back for it as we go forward and hopefully be able to use it if we can get an opportunity to do what we're trying to do.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Thursday, July the 28th, 2022. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And you can show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to welcome in the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network, as well as RisingApple.com. Well, I teased a little bit coming to you with an historical perspective, a little thing about the Subway Series. And as we got into the game and as we got into the off day, I said to myself, let's hold it till the two games are over so I could give a little introduction and thoughts about the series. What you're going to hear in just a little bit, and we'll get into some of my thoughts about the series and current things, you know, DH talk and who could help lengthen the Mets lineup. We'll get into that. You're going to hear an interview that I conducted in 2017 on the 20th anniversary of the Subway Series. Dave Malicki joined me. Dave Malicki actually joined me before he did SNY and the whole circuit at that point, because I was like, hey, let's get, was able to reach out to him. I think it was over Facebook, and he was kind enough to give me some time. We talked about that game. And obviously, when I get these guys on, I like to talk a little bit about their careers. So again, like I always say, some of these vault audios are not as clean, and the technology wasn't as available as it is today. So I forgive me if you have more of a voiceover IP experience when you hear the interview, but I think you'll enjoy it. And Dave is a great guy, and I had a great conversation. So even though it's the 25th anniversary of the Subway Series, and we talked a little bit about that with John Jastrzemski on Sunday, you're going to get to hear my conversation with Dave Malicki from 2017, where we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Subway Series. So you heard the clips coming in. You heard the Diaz save. You heard the big hit from Starling Marte to win it on a walk-off in the ninth inning. You heard Buck's perspective in the postgame. And what do you expect with Buck Showalter? It is truly, and I have always said this, he never gets too high, he never gets too low. Not that he puts cold water or dampens cold water on things, but he's always like, hey, great experience, a lot more bridges to cross. They have a tough schedule in August. Everybody knows that. They get a little bit of a blow over the next 6 days, or six games, I should say. They're off today as they play the Marlins and the Nats. After a big Subway series, those are the kind of series that you have the come down, because the atmosphere in Miami is going to be 180 degrees different than what it was at Citi Field. So got to keep perspective onto the next, focus on today's game. So, you know, you got to love Buck. As I said, he's everything that I could have asked for. He's the Pat Riley, in my opinion, of the Mets. He's having that same kind of impact on this organization that Pat did when he came over to the Knicks in 1991. Can't say enough. We've talked about that a billion times. But let me get to the Subway series and give you a quick synopsis, because I'm going to have a regular show here, but I don't want to go on too long, and I do want to get so you can enjoy the Dave Malicki historical perspective. These were two fun games. They were really fun. I hate to be the wet blanket, and maybe I'm showing my curmudgeonly age, but it's not the same as 97, 98, 99, 2000, and 2001, and even to a certain degree, 2006. These are playoff games. I said over the weekend when I spoke to you on Sunday, the kind of games, the kind of ways that they have to be managed, and the intensity and the experiences that the players have talked about, this is what you're going to experience in a playoff series, whether it be, you know, Subway Series in July or San Diego on the weekend and the ESPN Sunday night game. This is the kind of baseball that you will play night in and night out in October or November, depending about how deep you go into these postseason series and tournaments. So it was interesting. Even though you have Buck, who has tons of experience and has played, has managed teams in the postseason, he has won a championship, and I don't believe he's ever been to the World Series with the team. He has managed teams in the postseason, understands it. Scherzer's won a championship. You heard, whether it be Escobar or Pete Alonso, not surprising there, a lot of the guys talk about how maybe to a certain degree surprised at the intensity, the environment, how fun it is, the crowd. And you forget that the Canas, the Escobars, the McNeils, the Pete Alonzos, guys like that, have never really been deep into the postseason or experienced, in a case, a postseason series. Even if they've played in the postseason, some of these guys have been in and out, maybe in a short division series, maybe in a one-game playoff. You know, Oakland went into Yankee Stadium and lost. I know Escobar's with Milwaukee. But let's face it, even though there's crazy environments, I mean, a few years back, if you remember, the Toronto environment was as crazy probably as any environment you could have in North American sports. It's just not like Citi Field, or if they were at Yankee Stadium, which they will be in about a month or so. It's not the same, and they're experiencing it for the first time. And although we're clearly in the what does this team need phase, and we know who the Mets are, and they continue to prove who they are, it's almost like they had to use the San Diego game or even the Subway Series as a measuring stick for themselves, because it was an opportunity to kick themselves into gear. I thought after they had won the two games with the Cubs, they had a very sleepy game before the break. They were very sleepy coming out of the break. Yu Darvish will do that to you. Blake Snell, even though he's not having a great year, will do that to you. But they also let a few Padres relievers that I think didn't really deserve to be off the hook. And then they get into this atmosphere. They fall behind pretty quick in game one. It's like, all right, let's kick this thing into gear. Let's get back to being the team that we've been for the first 60, 70% of the year. And, you know, play two very entertaining, very fun ball games. The Subway Series has always been, and I've said this to you, historically for the Mets, an opportunity to get a taste of playoff baseball and really put a measuring stick and train yourself. Hey, this is what it's going to be like. Everybody's different. Everybody handles the spotlight and stress different. And if you could get a little taste of that in a regular season game to prepare yourself, to develop some of that muscle memory, or to calm your nerves, or to clear the mechanism, to borrow that line from For the Love of the Game and Kevin Costner, why not? Because they're clearly kicking themselves into the get-it-done gear. Next week, at this time, there's no more talk about who the Mets are going to acquire. The team is going to be the team. It's going to be about how can they get it done. And these are the kind of things that are as important. Experiencing that and being successful are as important as who they're going to get before August 2nd to be the designated hitter or whatever. It's funny because I keep thinking about when this thing went, because it's not the same. It was fun, though, and it definitely is headed in the right direction, the Subway Series. I think I have to accept that it's never going to be the charm of the initial four or five of them, because anything new is like that. But it has gotten stale. But I think around 2008, the Yankees didn't make the postseason that year. The Mets had made it, were close, but no cigar at the end. I kind of felt it dipped off. In 2007, it was still kind of there, but it dipped off. You were already 10 years plus into the thing. This is the first time since around the 08, 09, when these teams played, where I felt there was a lot of media excitement, especially. But the fans got back into it. It's also a different fan base. Maybe the fan base that's younger, that I take for granted, if you're 25 years old or so, you weren't old enough. To understand or experience 97. Because you were a baby. So their experience for the first time, they're different, and it's a lot more unique to you. I can say that, and this is anecdotal, of course, the atmosphere at Citi Field was widely pro-Mets. Historically, when you go back to the 90s Yankees, Mets, it was always aggravating that the Yankees fans would have a big percentage of Shea Stadium at the time. It'd still be more Mets, but it was a skush more Mets. And then you go to Yankee Stadium, and it would be very pro-Yankees, maybe 70-30. The gap was always shrunk. The Mets never really had the full home field advantage. I felt, you know, there was a good number of Yankees fans. You heard them cheer when Gleyber Torres hit the home run to tie the ball game off of David Peterson. But it was very, very, very pro-Mets, and it was heavily pro-Mets, similar to what I believe you'll see pro Yankees at Yankee Stadium. It will be interesting. Maybe the tide is turning. You know, I've talked about the attendance numbers. The Yankees' attendance is down. The Mets' attendance, although not growing, and they've only sold out three games. I'm assuming now it's four, because I'm sure last night was a sellout as well. You know, maybe there is this burgeoning Mets fan base that's getting behind this team and this new owner, and the fact that this is a connected team that represents all the New Yorkers, all the boroughs. They're much more of a touchy-feely, down-to-earth, blue-collar organization. We may lose some of that, I've said, as Steve Cohen continues to invest and build them into East Coast Dodgers, if you want to use that. So everything positive out of this, even if they had lost one or two of these games, I wasn't going to go crazy. Does it feel good to beat the Yankees? I'm sure all of you listening that are Mets fans feel good beating the Yankees. Is it the same for me? No. To me, I'm feeling good because the Mets are up four games in the loss column, three games over the Braves. They won a big game that they, you know, they easily could have lost. And it's the cherry on top that it was about the Yankees. And it was, more importantly, it was the atmosphere. If those two games were against the Dodgers, maybe it wouldn't be talked about the same. But I have a feeling that the atmosphere would be the same. Maybe more so on the weekend than during the week. Well, you know, that's a different story. And the wins would be sweet, just like the wins were very sweet when the Mets went out to L.A. and we had our friend Anthony Rivera from Subway to Shea on, and we came on just a little bit after the big Adonis Medina save. To me, that was as fun as the Subway Series. But this is a good test, and it really brought to light to me the experiences that some of these veterans, like an Escobar, haven't really had, even though they've been in the league a long time, because they've been playing in smaller markets. They haven't played in a ton of playoff baseball. And that's one thing, if you look at the Mets roster. I mean, Daniel Vogelbach comes over from Pittsburgh and he says on Sunday, this is the best atmosphere I've ever played in. I mean, he's a young player. He's about 30 years old, but he hasn't been in the league 5 minutes. So it really goes to show you, when you play in these other markets like Milwaukee and Seattle and Oakland, even if you have a taste of playoff baseball on the road, maybe at Yankee Stadium or Houston or whatever, it's not the same for these guys, or it's jumping out at them. And when the lights get bright and they're playing a five-game, seven-game, or maybe they're a wild-card team and they're playing a three-game series at Citi Field against San Diego or St. Louis or, you know, Philadelphia, whoever, this is what it's going to be like, and you've got to step up, because those other teams have good players too. Those other teams, especially in the short series, are going to have good bullpens maybe and a good closer and an ace that neutralizes a Scherzer or a DeGrom or a Bassett or whatever. So this was a fun, accomplish what, from a real practical baseball standpoint, you want to accomplish, which is let's get a little atmosphere going. Let's push ourselves. Let's test ourselves. Mets, you know, we know the Mets are. The Mets are testing themselves. Now, you did see, and this is what the interesting part is here. We know the Mets need a bullpen arm. We know everybody's pining for David Robertson. We'll get into the rumors. There's a Wilson Contreras, David Robertson rumor. Mets are going to have to give up some prospects. As I said, there's going to be pain this trade deadline. You're not going to like the packages if you get any of these guys. Story for the after the break. But outside of Ottavino and Diaz, the blueprint you saw in the first game where he went Walker and then he pushed Ottavino to almost two innings and then he went four outs with Diaz. Who does Buck trust? And did Seth Lugo, I'm not going to say he looked vintage Seth Lugo, but he looked good last night. He had his command, his curveball was sharp. Even though he wasn't throwing 100 miles an hour, he was able to locate and get swings and misses. Can Lugo get back into the circle of trust? Because I wasn't crazy. When I saw Peterson warming up and Scherzer was getting some trouble in the seventh, and I'm like, well, why would he bring him in? And then I looked at who was coming up. I'm like, all right, he's going to try to put Peterson into a situation where he's a lefty. Can he go out and get lefties out like Carpenter, like Hicks, like Rizzo? And I know Torres was in between, but you guys know the numbers. Peterson is very nasty when he gets ahead of hitters. He has almost a 50% strikeout rate. And this is a chance for the Mets to see, you know, when we go out, do we need to go out and get two bullpen arms maybe? I'm totally speculating, but I'm sure part of that is, let's see what this guy's got. Big game, big atmosphere, lefties coming up. Can I use him? Because if DeGrom stays effective and healthy, if DeGrom stays healthy, he's going to start. Not going to go into bullpen. Peterson is not really needed except for a couple of doubleheaders coming up the rest of the year. And you also have Trevor Williams, so there's always that possibility that he sneaks into that conversation if you acquire a couple of bullpen arms. Because if you go up and down, the Mets might not be able to keep Peterson on the roster. Because you got Diaz, you got Drew Smith, you got Seth Lugo, you got Ottavino, you've got Trevor Williams, you got Tommy Hunter. I'm assuming those six aren't going anywhere, including Tommy Hunter, unless something crazy happens. Yoan Lopez's spot and Joely Rodriguez's spot are the weak links. You know Trevor May's coming back, so he's going to take one of them. So you really only have one of the spot, and you can't carry more than 13 pitchers. So more than likely, David Peterson's going down to AAA, unless they say, you know, maybe we could sneak him in there and find some way to keep him around. There's also been talk, and this is Twitter talk, do the Mets move on from Seth Lugo if they could get a Robertson or a second big arm? I don't know if they have room until the rosters expand, and that's when you bring Peterson back, to have two acquisitions. So you really have to get, and I think Andy Martino reported this, that the Mets are really looking for somebody who can get lefties and righties out. So you do want, it was interesting that Buck used a big game, and I know the fans hate it. You know, my dad texted me, you know, why is he doing this? Well, Buck's looking this on the long game. He's not getting too caught up in one game. And I think even the Mets took this, I don't want to say more serious. I think both teams had fun, but back in the day when it was Bobby Valentine and Joe Torre, you would not see Peralta or Peterson making their way into these games. They would have to push. You might have saw Mariano for two. You know, Clay Holmes pitched one, and they might have saw Mariano for two. Holmes would have to do a Mariano on that. So I really think, to me, it's very clear that Robertson is the guy. The Mets need that second closer type. And why not get someone who has closed? And they're a free agent, so you know I know that these guys want to make money and closing games make money. But I think the way the league has evolved now, it's not like all of a sudden, you know, they're not going to be able to get paid to be a closer in the market because they set up for Edwin Diaz for, you know, 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever it may be. They need someone who could cross over lefty-righty. The situational lefty type, the Joely Rodriguez type, the old Jerry Blevins type, the Pedro Feliciano type, may God rest his soul. They're antiquated. You have to get lefties and righties out. And Peterson could do that. He's not ready. He fought. Peterson, you saw why. He's always probably going to leave you lacking until he really hones in on his command. He threw one strike to Rizzo, but he didn't get ahead of him. And then sure enough, the next guy's up, hey, I'm going to wait for his fastball because he doesn't want to walk another guy. Bing, bang, boom, tie game. That's why walks out of the bullpen are a death knell. And until he gets to a certain level, he's always going to be probably a frustrating back end of the rotation starter. Valuable, but never anybody that you completely love. And he'll make money doing that if he can pitch pretty similarly to how he's pitched this year for the rest of his career. He'll make good money. And, you know, he'll be a guy at the bullpen that you're like, ah, do I really want this guy in a big spot? So the other thing is, and our good friend Howard Megdell, and I actually texted him yesterday, say, wouldn't be a press conference. Howard always loved bringing up bullpen management to Willie Randolph or Jerry Manuel, because it's always been a bugaboo for Howard. If anyone who's listened to this show for a long time knows that, you know, the author of the Baseball Talmud and other fine books that you should check out, Google Howard Megdell on Amazon, you'll see them. Brought up Diaz and what it would take for Buck to do Diaz multiple innings, because let's face it, he's so good. And you saw the maturity and the evolution of Edwin Diaz right in front of you. We've talked about him. I talked about why he's my favorite Mets all-star and how important he is. And I even said he's probably the Mets MVP for the first half. But here's a situation which was prime for Diaz to take a step back. Got a cheap hit. That's been a marker of his entire Mets career. Somebody nubs one out because he's so nasty. His pitches are so nasty that some silly contact goes into no man's land. Then he gets an out. That's the big out. So you saw the difference where he didn't spiral after a bad situation. But then another bad situation happens, his own doing, where he doesn't make the right play. He tries to rush a double play with Judge running, probably not going to get it on the tapper. And the ball slips out of his hands. Now it's first and second, one out. You got middle of the order coming up. And in the past, his command would go off. He'd fall behind. You're thinking, I know you are, oh my God, someone's going to get a hole in one and tie this ball game up. Or you're going to see this total meltdown inning where they're going to have to go and get him out of there and bring somebody in. And now it's going to be one of these heartbreaking losses. Worse so for fans because it's the Yankees and because maybe their mother, their father, their brother, their sister, their significant other is going to be in their face about it. Nobody wants to go home and deal with that. Well, Edwin Diaz says, not this time. He even said in the postgame, he laughed about it. Maybe that's how he needed to handle the adversity. But he nodded his head up and down, and bing, bang, boom, he gets the outs. I mean, an historically good season. The strikeout rate is insane. It's video game-ish. And that, to me, out of all the things that have happened over the last couple of days, we know Max Scherzer's a big-time guy. We know he's going to pitch big-time in the postseason when he's given the ball. The question is, can he stay healthy and get the ball? Can he get the ball multiple times? Can he even come out of the bullpen after he's made a start later in a series? Because he couldn't do that for the Dodgers. His body didn't hold up. That was the question when he was signed. That was it. We knew if he was healthy. I didn't really believe Max Scherzer was going to get New York-itis. The big thing we learned is Diaz has evolved. And if Diaz has evolved, the question is, how many times in a big spot can he go 4, 5, 6 outs? Can he do it on back-to-back? Is he built that way? He's a wiry guy. We don't know much about his ability to recover after stressful outings. We do know, historically at least, and I don't have data in front of me, but my observations has been once he hits 25 pitches, now that's in an inning. I'm not talking about over 2 innings. That's a different analysis, the up and down. The up and down creates a whole different situation. When he hits 25 pitches, his effectiveness goes away. When his sharpness goes away and he falls behind, he has been more confident, as the data and the metrics indicate. He's about 50-50, maybe slightly higher, where you're going to get a slider. They just wait on that fastball. The fastball, though, has so much more movement. Even saw that with I think it was Judge when he went after Judge before the era. So to see that, you know, think back to how the Yankees, as they got deeper into their 4 championships and 5 years run, yeah, they had Nelson and Stanton, and that bridged the gap from whoever was starting the ball game. But when it got to the 8th inning, Joe Torre went, and even in big games against the Red Sox in the regular season and maybe the Subway Series against the Mets, Rivera would go 2 innings. Now, you had to spot it, and Joe would typically not want to start doing it till later in the year, because do you need to do it in May? I mean, sometimes there are these must wins. Maybe you're on a losing streak, whatever. He brought him in that way against the Dodgers. That was June. He did it against Anaheim on that road trip. And I think he did it because he
and his explanation to Howard was he was available. There was other times he was available to do that. He probably wanted to save some bullpen. Maybe he was a little short in other parts of the bullpen. And he wanted to win those games. He wanted to win and split against the Dodgers because that's a big statement. He wanted to win and end the road trip, the West Coast trip on a high note against Anaheim and not have Mike Trout beat him. So he brings him in the eighth inning. And Diaz has been fabulous on that. Now, have they done it time and time and time again? You didn't see him have that when he was really, was he 3 days in a row? You didn't see him push him against the Braves when they could have used him. Well, they lost that game, but he wasn't going to pitch in that game, in the second game of that Atlanta series recently because, you know, Buck didn't want to push him. But in a postseason series, three games in three nights, let's say a wild card series, or in a five-game series where you may get a day off in between two and three, but that's it, he's going to have to go 2 days in a row or three out of four or four out of five. Are you able to do four outs plus on each one of them? Mariano, for a lot of these series, maybe didn't have to all the time, but he would. And if you remember, the Mets lost the 2000 World Series because Stanton, Nelson, Rivera. That's where the game was over. It was a five-inning game. And the Mets for the first five or six innings were every bit as good as the Yankees. But the third part, Benitez, Franco, Turk, Cook, those guys, especially Benitez, who was good, but he wasn't Mariano. He wasn't locked down. They weren't. And the Yankees basically said to the offense after the fifth, sixth inning, you're not going to score. And this Yankees team, if you face them in a short series, even these no-namer guys they got coming out, they got great bullpen arms. I wish whatever Billy Epler could glean from his buddy Cashman, the one thing I wish he could glean, and he was over there, he hasn't been there in a long time, is how are they figuring out how to get all these arms, whether it be their own or acquisition like a Clay Holmes, and turn them into elite relievers? Tell me, please. Please tell me, because I like them to know. So that, to me, is a really big takeaway. You know, they need another arm. They're going to get another arm. I hope it's an elite impact arm. You know, not just some throw-in in a deal with the Nationals for Juan Soto. And, or more like Josh Bell. I shouldn't say Juan Soto because I don't think that's happening. I've been telling you that from the start. So that's that. So fun 2 days. Put it in the books, to quote Howie Rose. Move on to the next. And good for bragging rights. But no bigger than going out. All this gets negated if they go and play poorly against Miami and Washington down the Mid-Atlantic corridor there. They got to play well down that Mid-Atlantic corridor because then they come back for a big series against the Braves. Two really big series. We're not going to get into that today, but you have a great opportunity. Four up in the loss column, winnable games against two teams that, the Nats got plucky against the Dodgers. You cannot take anybody for granted this time of the year. Even if it's a team at some point that gets ripped apart, remember, there's always young players on the other side that are fighting for their baseball lives, fighting to make money, fighting to stay relevant. And when that's in play, sometimes talent, maybe just for a night, doesn't matter. And we've talked about that. So, all right, let's take a quick break. We're not going to get to the Malicki vault just yet. When we come back, very shortly, I've been assessing it. You know, there's J.D. Martinez rumors. People want Brandon Drury. There's rumors about Wilson Contreras. I'll give you where I think the Mets, Trey Mancini, where the Mets really need to get into this and how, what would be the best deal out of all the rumored deals. So I'll talk about that more right after this. The Talking Mets podcast is available on many outlets, but the most popular is Apple Podcast. Hi, I'm Mike Silva, the host of the Talking Mets podcast, and I encourage you to leave a review about the program on Apple. Just rate it 1 to 5 stars, hopefully a 5 because why wouldn't you? And then if you have time, leave a review. It helps the podcast continue to grow and encourages others to take a listen. You can also email me at mikesilva@talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, talkingmetspodcast.com. Hope to hear from you soon. And enjoy the rest of the show. All right, we're back. So, real quick, before I get to the vault and the Dave Malicki interview, because I know some of you guys like how we go back in history. So, there's a lot of rumors here. There's rumors that the Mets are interested in Trey Mancini. I'm not going to get into Juan Soto anymore, because I think we all have talked about that ad nauseum the last 2 weeks. I don't think it's going to happen. And I think it's fairly obvious why David Robertson, in my opinion, is the best bullpen arm to acquire. And really we've talked about requiring it in separate trades, but you may be able to kill two birds with one stone with Robertson with the Cubs. Something that I wasn't always hot to trot about with Wilson Contreras, but I'll get to that in a minute. So first off, you have, here's the names you're really hearing, the breadcrumbs we're hearing about Mets DH options. And they're all right-handed bats or switch hitters. And, you know, the first one is J.D. Martinez. And let me be frank about J.D. Martinez. I think he's the best overall option out there. Best resume, elite hitter, free agent, Boston, played in big games, won a championship there. You can't ask for more than that. The problem I have with J.D. Martinez is, with the qualifying offer now in play, because the international draft was not agreed upon, the Red Sox are going to have to assess, will they offer him the qualifying offer? That's a big if, but it depends on his health because there's back issues. And that bothers me a lot. And it's been recent back issues, last 3, 4, 5 week. Back issues are a bad thing. You don't want to acquire someone, give up prospect capital, solve what you think is an issue, and then the guy's sitting most of the time and compromise the entire time he's here. To me, that's a very, very dangerous, dangerous game to play. He has hit with much less power this year, which indicates something might be going on. Yes, he hits left-handed pitching. He's a righty bat, hits left-handed pitching at a high level, exactly what they need. But you're not giving up prospect capital for a guy like J.D. Martinez to play 30% of the time only against lefties. You're basically putting Volker back on the bench, and you're putting J.D. in there. And the last 2 months, he's only hit 4 home runs, and he's hitting about .230, and his OPS is under .700. I mean, that's what you're getting from J.D. Davis. I mean, really, he's pretty much been J.D. Davis the last month. You have J.D. Davis. You don't have to give up anything to keep J.D. Davis for J.D. Davis production. And to a certain degree, the more I look at Trey Mancini, another guy, righty bat, has some versatility where he could play the outfield in first base, so he could give you a little bit more than just a DH, like maybe a J.D. Martinez, who, you know, he could play outfield J.D., but I think you're going to just put him in as a DH. Again, very much numbers like J.D. Davis the last couple of months. Better, you know, this month it's been .230 batting average, but the power is not necessarily there. He historically hits lefties, hasn't really hit lefties this year, and he's been really bad the last, you know, week to 10 to 14 days. Now, some of that could be the rumors and the changeover that is swirling around him, but I told you, all these guys come at risk because you're uprooting them from comfortable situations they're familiar with. Familiarity and a routine are big in sports. They're big in life, and you're uprooting them, and how can they handle that? And then you've got Brandon Drury. Now, Brandon Drury, I know the Braves now, because Adam Duvall is out, are looking at him, and I think that's a good move, especially against left-handed pitching. And he was really good for the Mets as a bench mobber. Big hits, big home runs, things like that. And he's played at a very high level, the level that was always kind of thought about with him. They always knew he had power, but many thought he would be a very solid everyday third baseman. And I think he's gotten a little versatility now, playing the outfield and everything like that. Definitely could hit lefties, would be a nice complement to Vogelback. But and I know he's had eye surgery, so maybe he's evolved. Maybe some of the issues he's had were due to health, and maybe that's been fixed. And sometimes guys figure it out late. Look at J.D. Martinez. He figured it out later. So you can't discount totally what you see. And I think he'd be a solid addition, and he might be a better addition than the other two guys if you're only going to play him against lefties. And he could play against righties too. But his numbers in Cincinnati, OPS over 900, are far exceeding the 750, 760, 770 OPS you're getting on the road. So I'm anticipating he's a little over-indexed, and you're going to get a solid guy that's going to strike it a lot. It's going to hit lefties better than a tough righty. Could be a good platoon. I don't think he'll mind playing 40% of the time. Probably will hurt his market value, but somebody will pay him based on his performance in Cincinnati, especially if he gets big hits with the Mets. And I don't know how much he'll cost. You know, that's the really good question. What are the, you know, is there a you know, again, now the qualifying offer in play, you know, what is that? How does that factor in to all these guys? Now, you might say Cincinnati's not going to do that to someone who may take it. I don't know, you know, Drury's situation and what his market would be after this season. He's a DH type, so it might be limited. But you got to think about that, because if you have to give up, you're going to have to give up something that you don't want. Maybe Drury's the only one you don't have to give up too much of a painful prospect. You know, Mancini too, but the Orioles front office is smart. They're going to try to find somebody that they know the Mets need somebody. Maybe not as much as a week ago now that they have Vogel back, but they need somebody. I think the trade right now that makes the most sense is, and this is the most painful one, it might cost the most out of all of them, even more than J.D. Martinez, is Wilson Contreras and a David Robertson combo. You're bundling them together. There's been some buzz that this is something that the Mets were more interested in a Robertson situation than both, but Contreras could DH. Contreras could lengthen the lineup a little bit if you want to put him behind the plate. I think you saw how valuable Nito could be. Big plays by throwing behind the runner and getting the out at second base in game one. I know he and Scherzer on, you know, kind of trying out that pitch calm. I love, by the way, how Scherzer talked about pitch calm. I still don't understand how long-term that's going to work, especially as it gets loud in the playoffs, but whatever. I'm not going to get into that today. McCann is a great catch-and-throw guy. McCann is great at managing the staff. Contreras is better, way better offensively than the both. And I know that I've heard some rumblings that his game calling is not great. He's not a bad catcher at all, but I don't think he's in the same class as those other two guys. So you're really bringing him over as a DH. But, you know, you also, your downgrade is not that bad. Now, the thing is, Bassett, Scherzer, DeGrom, you know, they're going to have a say, hey, I want to throw to my guy. I mean, remember, I always talk about how back in the day, the Mets had Charlie O'Brien, Mackie Sasser, and Rick Cerrone. Nobody wanted to throw to Mackie. He was the best hitter. They wanted to throw the other two guys. So you don't want to get into that kind of situation. But to me, that's where the Mets need to go, because Contreras hits lefties. You're not going to platoon him per se, but you could also play him pretty much every day because he could catch. The other guys, I don't know if you're going to throw a Mancini or a J.D. Martinez in the field all that often. So really, to me, that's the trade that makes the most sense as we get close to the deadline. This conversation may go stale today. Who knows by the time you hear that? Off day, right before the trade deadline, perfect day to make a deal. Yankees made a deal right after the game for Andrew Benintendi. And there was another name that was on the Mets list, but I never thought that that was as serious because the lefty bat, outfielder, I think they're looking more DH type and righty, someone that could help them against left-handed pitching. And who has pop? The Yankees have plenty of pop. They need what the Mets have. Mets kind of need more of what the Yankees have. So all these guys add that with pop. So that's kind of where I'm at with the trade deadline. I think that might be the most painful trade. That's the trade I'm honing in on. Our good friend Pat Ragazzo from SI even talked about it yesterday on Twitter. So we'll see. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting over the next few days. There'll be definitely an opportunity to have a good show very soon. Maybe as soon as tomorrow. Who knows? So anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Dave Malicki. You guys know who he is. The former Met who pitched the first Subway Series game at Yankee Stadium in 1997, a complete game shutout. Oh, where has the complete game shutout gone? But anyway, I had a chance to talk to him on the 20th anniversary of the Subway Series in 2017. We are going to replay that on the 25th anniversary of the Subway Series right after this.
You're looking at 29-year-old right-hander Dave Malicki, who will take the mound for the Mets. Got it. Looked like an off-speed pitch, and O'Neill is down on strikes. Struck him out. And then he'll move to where he wants to go. That was a curveball that caught the inside corner, and Jeter is down on strikes. Three strikeouts for Malicki. That is in there, and he knew it. Another good hook from Malicki. He's got four punch-outs.
I think you'd sell tickets, though, with Maris, Mantle, and Strawberry. Witten goes down on three pitches.
Check swing by Kelly, the appeal at first, and the swing is called by Don Dankinger. Another breaking ball and call, strike three. Wow, comes right back with the hook.
He got it. He locked him up with a curveball. And Dave Malicki, in his 48th Major League start, has pitched a complete game shutout for the first time in his Major League career. What a performance. A pitcher that was supposed to be the weak link in the Mets rotation against one of the Yankees' best has pitched the Mets to a win in game one of this three-game series.
We're back. You guys heard the audio clip 20 years ago, and it's now 20 years since the first Subway Series. And joining us, he pitched in that first game. He pitched a complete game shutout. Complete game, something you don't see too much of today, and it's Dave Malicki. Dave, Mike Silva here in New York. Pleasure to have you on. I know that you know, obviously talked about this a billion times. We'll do it a billion and one. Are you tired of it? I mean, your career was a lot more than one game, but obviously here in New York, we like talking about that game.
Yeah, no, I'll never get tired of talking about it, I guess, right? You know, it is amazing. I feel like I did a lot of some neat things, but this was definitely up there, and it's a great memory I have, and it was something special. It was, you know, special to do it, you know, something like that in New York. And I think doing, you know, the first game is, I think, why everybody really remembers it. You know, I think if it happens, you know, today, it's still something really cool, don't get me wrong, but I think the fact that it was the first game that the two teams met is what makes it so special.
If you look back, and I know it's a long time ago, your starters, obviously, they planned them.
It is a long time ago.
It is. It's amazing because I remember watching that game live, and I'm 40 years old, Dave, and I'm like, geez, where is the time gone by? But when you were looking at the schedule as the week came on, were you expecting that? I mean, that was a big deal back in, and maybe today it's not. No one's really talking about next week's Subway Series, but maybe today, you know, that at that point, you know, everybody was circling it on the calendar. Were you as well?
Yeah, for sure. I remember when the schedule came out, I was really, really hoping I could at least just pitch in the series because, you know, you're, you know, 5-6 man rotation. You never know really how it's going to fall. And as it got closer, I was like, well, it's going to be close. Like, I'm either going to pitch the game, you know, the night before or that first game. And I was just hoping we wouldn't have a rain out or anything like that. And, you know, then Bobby stuck with me. And it was just a game I had looked forward to. And it's something I really, really wanted to do. And it was, you know, something special. And it was, you know, obviously something I'll never forget.
That team was actually the first year that the Mets had, you know, some respectability in a while. It was almost the innocent climb. Use that old Pat Riley term from the 99 and 2000 team. I know that you left a year later, but that team wasn't expected to do well. And I think before you even get to that series, what do you remember about that group? Because a lot of Mets fans actually remember that group fondly because there was low expectations. It was a fun team. You were in the wild card race. That series was one of the highlights, but there were so many other memories. And if you go, I don't know if you've looked into any of your old numbers, game scores, things like that. It wasn't even the best game you pitched. The best game you pitched that year, according to the game score, was a game you lost 1-0 to the Phillies later in the year. So it's pretty amazing. There was
right.
a lot of other memories
yeah.
I'm thinking that year as well.
Yeah, no, I did. I had some other good games for sure. I think it was just the game, you know, that game. You know, for us, we were, you know, the Yankees at the time. You know, we're the powerhouse. I think they won the World Series that, you know, the past year. Obviously, they're a great team. They're the old team still together. For me, playing in old Yankee Stadium was something really cool as well. Just the history. You know, I love the history of baseball and all that. And, you know, that was something special as well. But, you know, we had a great group of guys. You know, I think one thing that helped me out a ton was, you know, Todd Hundley. We just worked really well together. And that day, for whatever reason, I was just really calm, and it was a great feeling. But I knew I was going to do well. It's amazing how you can kind of I don't know what the right word is, but it was just eerily calm, and it was just so much fun. It was just a fun night. But yeah, Todd was great, and yeah, we had Gilkey and you know, Olerud, and I mean, we had so many, you know, great veterans. And then pitching wise, you know, John Franco is, you know, still one of the guys I've always looked up to. And you know, you got guys on the back end that can close a game. So I just figured if I could just go, you know, 6-7 innings and turn it over to the bullpen at the time, it was great. And the big thing for me was getting the 3 runs early in that first inning. And that made it it took a lot of pressure off. So if I did make a mistake, it wasn't going to cost us a game. And I think that really helped a lot.
You actually pitched the postseason game later in your career, but was that as intense of a game that you remember? I think it was later on with Houston you pitched in a postseason game, but
yeah,
the crowd and what have you.
It was for sure. You know, I think it was nuts. It was like a postseason game. I never made it to the World Series, like you said, but I didn't miss the postseason with Houston, and it was a different feeling. I think it was more excitement in the interleague game, to tell you the truth. Also, I think it's because we were playing in Yankee Stadium, and then so many Mets fans came to Yankee Stadium, which I thought was really cool. And to hear them, you know, do the "Let's Go Mets" chant in Yankee Stadium was pretty awesome. It was fun, but it was loud. It was, you know, it was a perfect night. It was just a great day. It really was for me.
I have with me Dave Malicki, former Mets pitcher. You guys remember him, 6-0 shutout back in 1997, first interleague game. You actually danced in and out of trouble throughout that game. If you think back, is there a moment, a pitch, an inning, a sequence that you remember where, you know, things could have maybe turned, and or maybe there's just one memory specific? I know, you know, the game itself, but is there one thing that when that game is brought up, maybe a moment that you think back of, big moment that you got out of trouble, or just something that always comes to your mind?
Well, the thing that always comes to my mind was just obviously just, you know, striking out Jeter to end the game. That was like, that was a thrill, but that, you know, the game was in hand at that point, obviously. And I had the bullpen warming up and everything was going, but that's the, you know, the big memory I have. Some other ones, just some other strikeouts, in the middle parts of the game, I gave up a bunch of hits. I felt like I could, you know, the big guys I was getting out, and then not the little guys, you don't want to say that, but the back end of the order, I had trouble with those guys. And, that's where I got in trouble. I feel like I gave up a hit almost every inning. I was like, holy cow. But it was just, I felt like I could get out of anything, which was really and a good feeling. And, I think to start the game, I think Jeter got a hit, reached on an error on second, and then I got the next three guys out. I didn't let them advance, and that gave me a ton of confidence. Just that first inning really kind of set the tone for me. And then again, if I threw a bad pitch, Todd got all over me. I remember one, I hung a slider to Cecil Fielder and hit it about, 7 miles foul left. And Todd came out, got on me and said, we got to, buckle up, do this. And so the next pitch, I threw the same thing again and just located better and struck him out. And it was times like that where I did get a little lucky at times. I think that when I made a mistake, they hit it, but fortunately that one, he pulled it foul. But now there are so many different, memories I can go through. It feels like it just happened, to tell you the truth. That's one game I really, really remember. I think what also brings it up is just, continually talking about it for sure. But the thing that amazes me the most too is, I still get letters and cards and stuff. I mean, at least once or twice a week from New York fans still want me to sign stuff, which I think is amazing that they can, that it still meant so much to so many people.
Yeah, that is true. The city was abuzz about that. Playing for Bobby V, I've met Bobby V. He's a pretty, big personality. He's a controversial personality.
Yeah.
That was always a wild time. Talk a little bit, because the fans always are interested in hearing how was it playing for Bobby Valentine, because obviously he's a polarizing guy, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, obviously good and bad. No, I think he was, at the time for that team, I think he was the right manager. He's been around the game forever and knows his baseball. I think sometimes he tries to do different things, which people, question for sure, different types of plays and different things. But yet it seems to work out a lot of the time. And he was a big personality. And, but I think he was absolutely the right manager for the time with that team. He could keep, the young guys, he kept those guys loose and would give them confidence, and the older guys, he would, let them lead, but yet kind of let them lead in the right direction, if that makes sense. So, it was never a dull moment. Let's just put it that way.
Now for you, that was some thought, a breakout game, and you had a decent Mets career. Your numbers, if you look at they go to advanced metrics, you were very a solid above league average pitcher. You started to struggle after that. What happened for you in New York? Because you went on to Detroit, and you actually pitched pretty well in '99 in a hitter's league, in a hitter's ballpark. That must have been an interesting experience. But what happened to you in New York? What really, if you look back, was there anything that you could point to where maybe it didn't go exactly as you wanted?
I feel like, I feel like I left with unfinished business. I mean, I loved my time in New York. I really did. It was a great place to be and live and the fans. I think what happened, who knows what happens, but, you know, I feel like I pitched really, really well for about 3.5 years. And then the last year I started struggling a little bit. And I think you if you lose a little bit, if you lose, focus, you lose your location, anything. I mean, big league hitters are hard to get out. They make you pay. And I think I just started pressing a little bit. And then I tried to do more than you really need to do, if that makes sense. Like, instead of just hitting my spots and hitting, what you need to do, I tried to, throw it harder. And every time you throw it harder, the location gets off, and that's when you get hurt. Location is much better than speed. And I think that was the big thing. It was a big growing point for me, because that was really the first time I kind of struggled a little bit. And you kind of have to go through growing pains a little bit, and it's hard to do that sometimes at the major league level.
I'm laughing as you say location's better than speed. Billy Wagner, I'm sure you remember him, sent a tweet out yesterday. I guess he's doing some baseball training. And I'm laughing because some kid, I guess, was going to velocity training. And he was tweeting about, well, what is that?
Okay.
What is velocity training? And you think about you pitching late into that game that we talked about, and you're pitching close to 190, 200 innings. You were a young guy. I don't know if you're involved at all in the game with your kids or in any capacity, but it's changed so much, I'm guessing. Even from just 20 years ago, you're a modern-day player, in my opinion, but doesn't feel like it anymore with the way things have transpired.
It really doesn't. So once the game ended for me, I definitely stepped away for a little bit, and then coached some high school baseball. And then my boys got a little bit older, I just started coaching their teams. But now my boys are freshmen and sophomores in high school, which I can't believe. So I'm helping coach the high school team here again, and I absolutely love it. It's coaching high school baseball is for me, it's so much fun and rewarding. But you're right, every kid I teach or help coach wants to throw harder, or wants to throw, first thing is a curveball at, 7 years old. And I wouldn't teach it until they got, old enough and strong enough. I think there's so much more, but, I try and bring up guys like, Greg Maddux and Tom Glavine, those guys, those guys did not throw hard, but man, they got everybody out. They won Cy Youngs, it's not about the speed. But I think it's also hard too. I happened to go to an Indians game last week with the kids, and they got the radar gun up on the scoreboard, obviously, and how hard everybody is throwing is just amazing to me. It's everybody's a lot bigger, stronger, and it is. I mean, I think that everyone throws really hard, but my personal belief is if you can hit that spot on the outside corner, it doesn't really matter how hard you throw. If you can move your pitches in and out and change speeds, if you talk to hitters, changing speeds and location is the hardest thing to hit. If you throw, 100 miles an hour and it's down the middle, they're going to hit it. And so I'm trying to teach guys to hit spots and have a go-to pitch. If you can throw a pitch down and away to a right-handed hitter, that's you could live there all day. There's not a whole lot you can do with that pitch. So. Although some of these guys are getting so strong now, they hit it to right field, hit it out over there. But it has changed a lot, and it's amazing. But I think every generation says that. I remember when I was pitching, everyone says, the older guys were saying that, it's changed since they were there. So, I think it evolves for sure. But I think good pitching beats good hitting any day.
I'm looking at your numbers as you're talking. In that Detroit season in '99, 14 wins. Not a good team, Tiger Stadium, where I guess the outfield's like up against your back out there. That was pretty impressive. It seems like you learned a little bit, in an offensive era for a variety of reasons. That was a very solid year. What do you remember about your time over there in Detroit?
Again, I did. I enjoyed it. It was a shock, because I was actually at the time of when the year started, I was in L.A. With the Dodgers, and you know, the weather's beautiful and everything's great. And then ended up getting, you know, I got the call that I got traded, and we just got finished playing the Diamondbacks, and they told me I just got traded to Detroit. And I was like, holy crap, you know, it's going to be cold. It was, but it turned out to be great. And especially pitching in that stadium. There was so much history. That's what I loved about it. But you know, any pop fly to right field went out. I don't know if you remember that old stadium or not. But yeah, the right field fence was short, and there was actually an overhang from the upper deck over the field. And it was a great stadium to watch a game in, but it wasn't that great of a stadium to pitch in unless you hit it to center field. The dimensions were really, really goofy, and that center field was, I mean, it was like 420, I think, or 430. It was something huge out to center, but then right field was, you know, just a regular pop fly would go out. But I think that actually helped. And there I really got a lot of help with Brad Ausmus. You know, he caught me there and in Houston. And, you know, Brad and Todd, I think, were two great catchers that I had. I was really lucky to be able to have those guys help me out. I learned a lot from them as well. It's amazing how much a catcher helps. And, you know, I learned a lot about pitching, a lot about myself, especially in Detroit. Those were the years I just started, I guess, kind of coming into my own, really, at times. And it was just it was a good time for me. I learned a lot about pitching in those types of stadiums.
And you're almost, if the Mets don't trade for you, you're almost part of that Cleveland team. That, you know, things, it's amazing how careers could go. You stay with the Indians, good team. They always needed pitching. They score a billion runs. They actually just did a special on, I don't know if you saw it, MLB Network, about that team with John Hart and some of your former teammates there.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how close you could have been to being with that team. And you come to the Mets, which was a transitional period. So it's amazing how things turn out, huh?
Well, for sure. Yeah. You know, coming up with Cleveland was, it was great. I had that chance in 92, and they actually called me up in September, and that's when that team was just starting to turn around with Tomy and Kenny Lofton and all those guys and Baerga. And, you know, I get to play with them, and I came up with them. And, yeah, I think I really was going to be a part of it. And then I hurt my shoulder. I tore my labrum my last start with the Indians. And, you know, speaking of that, I pitched the second-to-last game in the old stadium. So I pitched in the old stadium in Cleveland, if you remember that place. So there was like 70,000 people, I think it was a football stadium. So, that was a great time. And then, yeah, I got hurt and came back and pitched well, but then it took a little bit longer from that labrum. And then fortunately, you know, I got, traded over to New York, and it was for me. Yeah. Looking back, it would have been great to go through that and be with those guys. But, you know, I think when you're in a playoff run, you know, with playoff teams going to the World Series, you know, the young guys, you know, there's not really a chance to make a mistake or grow or do anything like that. And I think New York did give me that opportunity. So, you know, I think everything does happen for a reason. Sure, it would have been great to be a part of that team and to go through that. But, you know, I wouldn't trade for my time in New York. It was awesome.
You never thought about what would be if they had made you a reliever, especially the way relievers were coming in and making money and throwing bullets out of the bullpen? Because you did throw pretty well out of the bullpen with the Mets.
Yeah, no, I did. My personality was funny. Is I'm more of a guy that likes routine, and I like to know. I'm a schedule type of guy. Like I like to know when I'm going to pitch, what I was doing, when I was coming to the ballpark, what I had to do that day. And when I was in the bullpen, it was a lot harder for me, just mentally. I liked it in that I would only go, a couple innings, but I never knew which innings. You know, and at the end of my career, when I was in Houston, I was a reliever for, about a month, but I only would come in for about an inning. And actually that's when I threw the hardest my whole life was that, cause I could come in and just let it go and not have to worry about trying to get guys out two or three times. I could just throw everything I had at them one time and I'd never see them again through the lineup. That's what's, you know, so different about starting and relieving. You know, starting, I'm going to see a guy, you know, three times, maybe four times, and I got to get him out. Where, you know, as a reliever, they only see me one time, and I can throw everything at him. But, you know, personally for me, I just like starting a lot more. You know, a lot more. It fit my personality better, and it was just what I like to do. But, yeah, looking back, gosh, I it was awful when it was over. I wish I could still be doing it for sure.
Couple of things before I let you go. So who was the one hitter that wore you out? Maybe it might not be an obvious guy. Was there someone you think back? Who wore you out that when they got up, you're like, I just can't get this guy out? You'd be surprised. I get answers for that. It's not always the obvious answers for sure.
Yeah. There was a few guys, but the one that always comes to mind is Barry Bonds. The guy was just such a good hitter, and he would just make you, if you made a mistake, it was not a good ending. I felt like I always had trouble with him. And the other one that you're going to laugh at this one, but who I still think was the best hitter was Tony Gwynn. And I didn't have that much trouble with him because all he would do is throw a two seamer down the middle and he'd get himself out because there's no way you're going to pitch to get him out. He was such a good hitter. He was amazing. But I think those two kind of stick out. I had a little bit more trouble with the left-handed guys in my mind. I don't know if statistics show that or not, but I felt like against the righties, I could throw my slider and curveball and my two-seamer in on them, and I just had a little bit easier time with them. I felt more confident. I guess I shouldn't say easier. Just I felt more confident going against those guys. But, yeah, Barry Bonds kind of always sticks out in my mind.
What was your favorite ballpark to pitch in, and what was your least favorite one?
Oh, I get asked that all the time. Looking back,
people love that stuff. I know they do.
Yeah, I was the favorite one to pitch in would have to be Yankee Stadium because that has some good memories, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I Wrigley was fun to pitch in because just again the history. Old Tiger Stadium is as hard as it was. That was pretty cool to pitch in that too. Just because you're in the dugouts and you realize, who actually played in that stadium and sat in the same seat that I was sitting in. That stuff was pretty cool. Least favorite, I never really liked going to Montreal. It was just always kind of sterile in that dome. It was just the crowds weren't really that big. And I don't feel like it was a baseball town. But I honestly, all the towns, and actually Philly's a tough time to pitch in too because the fans there, man, they're rough. They can get on you pretty bad. But if you remember like Philly, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, all the stadiums were the same. Those were those generic, football / baseball stadiums. And, so they were just kind of, okay to pitch in, but again, you're pitching in the big leagues. It didn't really matter. But some of the newer stadiums, were fun to play in. I think those were fun for different reasons for sure.
So you'll probably get other calls over the next week. You'll probably at some point the clip is going to be played. Have you watched the game with your kids? I know your kids are younger. Do they look back at any games? Do you enjoy looking back at your career? They're playing ball now, or are you more like, hey, that was my career. Let's focus on the now. I think it'll be interesting because
right.
It's always fun when you talk to ball players. The kids look back and say, that's what you look like. That's how you played. For any kid, looking back
at
how their parents looked many, many years ago.
Yeah, it's funny to say that. It's different because my kids have never, I have pictures of me with my boys, on the field, but they were, 2 years old. They don't remember anything. So, it's funny. Like they know what I did and they know that I pitched, but I think now that, it's weird because they see me at home all the time or, just coaching baseball or stuff. I think it's different to me. I'm just their dad. I'm not a pitcher, I'm not a player. I think now it's starting to they think they realize it more and more, especially if we're at, games and then all their buddies can, pick up a cell phone now and pull up every stat on my career, pull up highlight tapes, and it's pretty funny. So then change things a little bit. So they're like, wow, you really actually did do something, but I think they've watched that game. I haven't watched it in it's probably been, 15 years or something. I really haven't watched it, but I feel like I see it all the time in my head. I remember it so vividly. I think I can kind of almost go inning by inning, really. I just, for whatever reason, that game really does stand out for me. So, I think they've watched some games with my parents and stuff like that, but we really have never really sat down and done that. I feel like, it was such, that you're, like you're saying, that was my time. And I'm sure they've seen some stuff, but I've never really pushed baseball on them. I want them to make their own choices and do what they want to do. And so my older one actually is, he's actually a really pretty good baseball player. But he plays baseball and hockey, and the younger one plays, he gave up baseball. That one was tough on me, but he gave up baseball for lacrosse, and he's a hockey player as well. So, you know, I let them do what they want to do and find what makes them happy. You know, for me, baseball was my life. That's what I wanted to do. And it afforded me so many great things. And, you know, that was my dream, and I want them to have, you know, their own dream. I don't push it on them. So, you know, hopefully they enjoy it. And, you know, I know my older one does. And like I said, he's pretty good. And so, you know, who knows? Let's see what happens.
Are you a baseball fan now, or because you played, you kind of, you know, focused on other things? Most players tell me they really don't watch the game after they, you know, play the game because you lived it for so long.
Yeah, I tell people that. I felt bad because I don't watch it that much anymore. I started watching it again now a little bit with my older one. Like I said, we went to an Indians game the other day, but, you know, the guys I played with and my old roommates are all, you know, GMs and coaches and stuff like that. So, you know, DePoto's a GM and Doug Henry, he's a pitching coach, and, you know, Mike Sarbaugh's my third base coach over at Indians now. And so that makes it fun for me. Yeah, I didn't watch it for a while. I'm starting to again. It's, you know, I tell people I watched, you know, 200 baseball games a year for 20 years. It's like I've seen a lot of baseball, Major League Baseball. So it's fun. That's why I can get my fix now by just going to the high school games and that. I thought I would like to look in, you know, maybe coaching in college or something like that, but I think that would be – that'd take up too much time for my family. I think that's why high school is just such a great fit for me right now. And it's fun. We've got a good program over here, and it's been enjoyable.
Well, listen, you've been generous with your time. I appreciate it. The fans here definitely do remember that. They don't get tired of this stuff, especially Mets fans. You know, you know that playing here, nostalgia is a big part. They may not have a lot of world championships, but nostalgia is. And look, you go down in the Pantheon, Dave. Doesn't matter if it's one game or 10 games or 100 games. You know, maybe it wasn't Piazza, but you're in that Mets Hall of Fame for that game.
Yeah.
So it's got to feel good. And we appreciate you spending a few minutes here. And let's catch up again. All righty?
Absolutely, anytime. I love talking baseball. So, and like you said, the New York fans were awesome. Loved them. So I appreciate it.
We like to look back at Mets history at the Talking Mets podcast, like on August 10th, 2017, when Dave Malicki joined me as we remembered his shutout of the Yankees in the first ever Subway Series in 1997.
The thing that always comes to my mind was just obviously just, you know, striking out Jeter to end the game. That was like, you know, that was a thrill. But that, you know, the game was in hand at that point, obviously, and I had the bullpen warming up and everything was going. But that's the, you know, the big memory I have. Some other ones, some other strikeouts. You know, early, you know, in the middle parts of the game, I gave up a bunch of hits. I felt like I could, you know, the big guys I was getting out, and then not the little guys. You don't want to say that, but the back end of the order, I had trouble with those guys, and. You know, that's where I got in trouble. I feel like I gave up a hit almost every inning. I was like, holy cow. But it was just, I felt like I could get out of anything, which was really and a good feeling. And, you know, I think to start the game, I think Jeter got a hit, reached on an error on second, and then I got the next three guys out, and I didn't let them advance. And that gave me a ton of confidence, just that first inning really kind of set the tone for me.
Listen to this and more at www.talkingmetspodcast.com. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. I hope everybody enjoyed this midweek edition of the Talking Mets podcast as we recap the Subway Series, another fun checkpoint in the season. We're days away from the trade deadline. We're days away from that. Hey, this is the team. Now it's time to go and get them. Jacob DeGrom is on the way back. That'll be a big story. Big two series against Atlanta. There's going to be a lot of fun baseball the next 2 months. I think there's going to be a lot of big games. I think there's going to be more sweaty situations like we saw in the past couple of days against the Yankees. So really, you know, like I said, I think the next, you know, six games or so are so important, because
it could give the Mets a little bit of a cushion, because as the Braves come into Citi Field, you know, really the Mets in a five-game series, all they have to do is really take three out of five, and they expand their lead. When you're the team ahead, the pressure to reel off 2, 3, 4 in a row, sweep, and even if you win a series by a game, you only pick up a game, the pressure's on the other team. And the odds, especially when you're playing a good team, for the Braves it's the Mets, for the Mets it's the Braves, very hard to sweep those series. And when you have elite pitchers like Scherzer, you have Bassett pitching again at a top of the rotation level, you have DeGrom coming back, even if it's for four innings. Right now, with the way that Diaz is, it's six outs you're trying to figure out. And if you could get yourself a bullpen arm like Robertson, you probably figured out three of them. You're figuring out three outs. And the Mets with Ottavino, with Lugo, can Lugo sneak back into this equation? That's the thing. Peterson's not even in that game last night. If we know Lugo is Lugo. If Lugo could sneak back into that and be a little bit more consistent, and maybe Buck hasn't trusted him to the level of Ottavino, nor has he deserved that Lugo. Ottavino's moved ahead of him on the pecking order. Amazingly enough, man, the math works really good in the Mets' favor. And yes, they need another bat, but they get, you know, their 90% win percentage. 90% of the time when they score five runs, they win. But if they hit that four-run mark, it's very hard to hit five-plus runs in a postseason series against elite teams with really good pitching. They score four runs with that starting rotation, with that bullpen that I just outlined with a Robertson and a much different Lugo. They got a real good shot at winning this thing. And it could be a really fun back half of the season, just as fun as those last eight or so weeks in 2015 that we experienced, which seems like yesterday, but it's 7 years ago and has been a long time ago. It'll be closer to 10 years since the last World Series than it's closer to, hey, it was just yesterday. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for joining me on this midweek edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You could check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you can show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to welcome in the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network, as well as RosieApple.com. As always, we love those guys. Well, guys, another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast very soon. We know it could be Sunday. It could be sooner. Buckle up. Plenty of news coming. Plenty of big games coming. Till then, I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy the games. Be well.